Hey, everybody. Welcome. It's midday. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Tom Hall. Last week, when Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott appeared on our show, he touted a 17% decrease in violent crime in our city compared to last year. Well, in fact, as of today, the 120 homicides recorded in Baltimore so far this year is 25 fewer than the 145 which were recorded at this same time last year. That is a 17% reduction. 22 fewer non-fatal shootings have occurred this year compared to last year, too. But as the mayor and other city leaders are quick to point out, the animating force behind the Group Violence Reduction Strategy, or GVRS, is the effort to address the root causes of the violence that has plagued our city for decades. Poverty, unstable housing, lack of job opportunities, and a street culture in which arguments escalate into violent retribution instead of conflicts being resolved peacefully. Violence interruption organizations disrupt the patterns of violence that have led to so many tragic results over the years. A little later today on Midday, I'll speak with the Senior Director of Gun Violence Prevention at the Center for American Progress to see how Baltimore fits into the national story. But we'll begin with Kurt Palermo, the Executive Vice President of ROCA Maryland, a violence interruption program based in Boston that has been active in our state since 2018. Kurt Palermo joins us on Zoom. Hey, Kurt, welcome back.
Good afternoon. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for your time. So am I correct in calling ROCA, which is the Spanish word for rock, by the way, am I correct in calling it a violence interruption organization? Is that accurate?
You know, the work that we do, we're certainly in the space, you know, the CVI ecosystem. Part of what we do is interrupting these, you know, conflicts and acts of violence with the young men we serve. But really, we're, you know, an evidence-based behavior health program, you know, a long-term intervention for the young men who are most likely to be the perpetrators or victims of gun violence in Baltimore City and, you know, also in Massachusetts and Connecticut, where we also work.
Give us a sense of the scope of who you're working with, the numbers of young men that you're working with, and the kind of young men, because you make it a point to find the folks who are really at the highest risk.
Exactly. And, you know, what is so important to know about this group of young men, you know, outside of the violence that they may have been the victim of or engaged in, is that they are so highly traumatized. And, you know, the things that they've been through or things they've witnessed that have been done to them are putting them in kind of the survival mode. And I talk about that a lot because it's important when we're considering engaging with them and, you know, maybe things that they participated in the past, whether it's school or a program or employment, and they just kind of blow out, right? They feel anxious, they're scared, they're paranoid because they're not feeling safe at that point. And they think everyone and everything is out to get them. So they, you know, fight, flight, or freeze. You hear that a lot. Most of the time, our young men are going to fight. So they're very reactive. And what we do is we go find them, right? We go to wherever they are in their neighborhoods. We engage with relentless outreach over and over, even when they don't want to come back, because we understand what the alternative is. We don't want to see them in jail or worse. And that right there is kind of the foundation of trust and that relationship that we build with them, so they do start to feel safe enough to engage with ROCA staff, to come to the building and even just see the opportunity that's in front of them to do something different, right? Because once they start identifying that trauma, addressing it, and engaging in something that's positive on a regular basis, they can achieve whatever goal it is, getting their GED, getting a job, addressing mental health, substance abuse, all these other things that where they are in that environment might not seem possible at the time, but we know that it is because we've seen it.
And many of these men are very reluctant to get involved. They are not ready at the initial point of contact that you make with them for a program of any kind. They're just not interested. What is your secret to eventually getting them interested?
I mean, the secret really comes down to the work that we're doing in these communities, and that relentless outreach piece that we say so much is we're going to keep coming back you're going to get tired of us before we get tired of you, because we truly care about you. You know, your life matters regardless of things that you may have been told or experience you've had. You know, there is something more for you than what you're used to, what you've seen every day. And I think that for so many of them, they've never had that. Or, you know, I'll say that most of them have been forgotten about by many people in their lives, many programs, many agencies, but we're here to kind of bring them back into that fold and show them that, no, there are these areas where you can grow and learn and, you know, be a positive example, you know, for your family, for your neighborhood, for this city of Baltimore. And just the consistency over and over and sending that message without judgment, and, you know, having that enough, they start to say, you know what, maybe I can do something different. And we're not going to force them. We're not going to decide for them, but we are going to be here to hold them accountable and have the uncomfortable conversations that a lot of people don't have with them, you know, about carrying weapons, about substance abuse, about domestic violence, about doing something different when doing the same thing is a lot more comfortable and you're used to it. But that conflict is what's going to see the great change in their lives. And that's what we really push. And then we also give them the opportunity to come to our building, to go to work, to, you know, try to achieve educational gains, whatever it is that they want, in a safe place where they can actually commit to that on a regular basis.
Kurt Palermo is the executive vice president of ROCA Maryland. It's a behavioral health program dealing with folks who are either at high risk of being perpetrators or victims of violence. Our number here, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. And Kurt, we talk about this a lot every time you're on the show, that trauma is the through line for so many of these young men. So to address the trauma, to, you know, get to the root of the problems that these young guys are facing, how do you do that?
I mean, there's not one approach that's going to be the cure-all, but I think the most important part for anyone, you know, these young men or anyone who might have been traumatized or is actively going through a traumatic experience, is to just create a safe enough space for them to start to address it. And, you know, we have our cognitive behavioral theory, which really focuses on, you know, what you think, feel, and do are three different things, but one can impact the other two. So can we get you to a place where you're taking an 8 to 12 second pause and getting yourself out of this survival reactive mode to use a CBT skill, to act on your values, to be present, to flex your thinking, things that are overlooked a lot of the time, but it literally could be the difference for a lot of people in general between something going very, very poorly or something positive happening or a situation that you simply just walk away from. And in addition to that, we have a mental health clinician who is here at the building doing outreach with the youth work staff to bring services to the young men that they may have never had. And we're not forcing it on them, but it's an opportunity for them to talk to someone different. You know, this is what I'm going through. And then can you help? Can you give me your advice, your guidance? You know, do they need long-term sessions? Is it just a few one-on-one conversations? You know, harm reduction is a perfect example. We talk about substance abuse and how that impacts trauma and how it's used as a tool to avoid discomfort. Well, can we get you to a place where you're not using as much? And then we start to get to a point where you're actually replacing whatever that is with something different, something more positive. So it's a long-term approach. You know, we have these guys for 4 years and we understand that it's not going to happen overnight and there's setbacks, but that goes right back to the relentless outreach. You know, you blow out, you say, I'm done with this. Things are getting hard and uncomfortable and don't come back to my door. Like, that's when they need us the most. That's when they need us to wrap around them and say, look, we're here for you. And it's not fun to address some of this stuff, but we're going to be there to support you no matter what.
You talk about how relapse is one of the stages of making changes. So what is, just in terms of the numbers of guys that you're working with, you've just issued a report that looks over the last 4 years that you've been active here in Maryland and Baltimore. How would you assess your progress so far in terms of, you know, successful outcomes?
I mean, when we talk about outcomes, a lot of the time it's, you know, how many or what percentage of your young men have recidivated, and we talk about employment and all of that is so important. But I think that if we're from start to finish, 4 years with these young men, if we're really talking about what goes into it, we have to talk about the, you know, the improved emotional regulation. I mentioned their mental health and just and what that looks like for them and how they can even access those services, you know, levels of distress. You know, these guys are going through so many things on a regular basis, and it's not healthy for them, but it's also a lot of the time not their fault. So how do we get them to work through that? Or, you know, substance abuse, that's a huge thing too, is if we're not identifying and addressing all of these parts, you know, stability in their living situation, access to transportation to get to work, we're never going to get to, you know, them not recidivating or them retaining employment long term. So it's an up and down. You know, a guy might be having a few good months and he's on the work crew, and then something happens and he, you know, quote, relapses and he blows up and doesn't want to be in the work crew anymore, and he slashes the tires and he cusses out the supervisor and he leaves. And that's a moment when we need to go follow up, bring him back, like have a conversation, talk about accountability, talk about what you're going through, like how are you feeling right now and what can we do to support you. And we can't push them out too soon, but we also have to create a foundation for them so that when they're not with us, they're using these CBT skills so that they can get to the point where, you know, they're successfully completing supervision, they're not getting arrested, they're not being incarcerated or detained, and they are able to keep that job wherever it is beyond just a few weeks where they get a paycheck. It's no, now you've been there for 6 months or a year and you're getting a promotion, and you don't have to do the things you used to do to get money to support yourself and your family that put you in harm's way.
And in your report, you note that when you talk about recidivism, your record in that regard is pretty good. You identify 84 young men who have been enrolled for 24 months or more, and you started with 400 plus folks. So and they come in at different times, but so 84 stuck with it for 2 years, and just 2% of them were terminated from the program for being incarcerated on new charges. And some of these guys, we're talking about people who've already been incarcerated, who are out now and, you know, trying to get some help. I talked to a terrific guy named Lindsay Johnson. He and his son run a waste and recycling company, L&J Waste. They cleared out the demo of what used to be the Royal Farm Arena, which is now the CFG Arena. He told me about the Roca guys that he has hired to work with their company, and that when they would show up to work, they'd be there, you know, for a full work day. And during the course of that day, a Roca person would call each of them sometimes 5 or 6 times during the day. It seemed like that was like every hour, hour and a half. They were just calling, hey, how's it going? How you feeling? How's the day going? What you up to? It's incredibly intensive. It's labor intensive, this program. Is that a real, you know, fundament of this? Does it take that kind of hovering? Does it take that kind of, you know, literally hourly involvement with these guys as they're going through these programs and getting used to a different lifestyle? Is that really a fundamental part of it and its success?
Yeah, so using the example of just employment, and, you know, L&J Waste and Recycling has been one of our best employment partners for, you know, several years. And the reality is, it's almost counterintuitive. Guy comes to Roca, he's in transitional employment, has his ups and downs, maybe he relapses, he gets terminated, he comes back, he's, you know, doing very, very well on crew. And we say, you know what, he's ready to go over to L&J Waste, or he's ready to go wherever. Most times you would think, okay, well, that young person's fine. He's going to go work. He's going to, you know, have a full-time job. Everything's going to be great. That's really when you have to double down on them, because for many of them, they've never had this new opportunity of work. And for most of them, Roca is their work history, right? So they're coming in every day. They have a youth worker. They have a crew supervisor. We're all trained in CBT. We're engaging with them. We're visiting with them, doing programs. They have development day on Fridays. We're doing tours of employers. And then it's kind of like, okay, now you're going to go off and you're going to go work at L&J. And they're right back to kind of that scared, anxious feeling. And they start to think, like, is this really what I want? And we've had a lot of guys just not show up before, not necessarily L&J Waste, but to, you know, jobs that were lined up, they interviewed, they were hired. It's because they're not used to it. So we had a young man start first day on the job yesterday. Youth worker called him on Sunday. We checked in with him yesterday. Did you get there on time? Great. Call us on your lunch break. Is there anything you need? Is there anything wrong? Do you have any questions? That's the type of follow-up. That's the type of relentless outreach and the relationship that it takes for so many of these guys. But that's what we're willing to do because we want to make sure that they're safe, they're out of harm's way, and they're doing something that they like and that is positive and they can feel proud of at the end of the day, because that's what it's all about, is showing up every single day. And I tell them all the time, if you're tired from being outside all night, that's a very different tired than going to work every single day and earning an honest living and coming home and feeling accomplished and talking to your family about, hey, I got my job at L&J Waste or whatever it is. That's such a different feeling, and it's a good feeling that so many of these guys have never had, but they deserve.
In terms of ROCA staff, do you have enough people to staff this kind of, you know, person-centric, intense, you know, relationships with the guys you're working with? I mean, you know, Mayor Scott tells me they can't hire guys to work or women to work at DPW. City Hall is understaffed. The Department of Transportation is understaffed. There's all sorts of employers in the private and public sector looking for people to work for them. And the kind of work you're talking about here at ROCA, you know, requires a good bit of training and a good bit of sensitivity and judgment and erudition.
We're definitely not immune to what, you know, you just said it, pretty much every industry across the country has faced in the last few years around the workforce and recruitment and hiring. But we're also very careful that we're not taking on so much that we have to go and just out of desperation hire more people to do this work, because it is such sensitive work and it's so relational. And there are, you know, stressors and triggers for so many people involved in any human service work. So we're very careful and we bring on, you know, we're vetting, we're interviewing, and we're training them when they get to us. And that's so important, is that training, the support, the on-the-job coaching, and then the high-level supervision. You know, we can't just have people out driving around, hanging out in the corner. It's, who are you going to see? Where are you going to be? What are you targeting them for? What do they need? Hey, we have barbershop today. Who are you bringing in? We're having a Father's Day event. Who on your list is a father? Right? The mental health clinician needs names to go do outreach. It's so specific and so intentional, because structure binds anxiety. And that's with the young people, that's with myself, that's with the staff. So we have to stay structured and we have to stay sharp in the work that we do, because we're accountable to the city and we want to be able to, without a shadow of a doubt, say, this is how many times we went to see the young person, this was the result, this is what they did, and now this is what they're doing outside of ROCA. And that's what's important to us, and with the data.
Yeah, and let's talk about the city. I mean, how does ROCA fit into this group violence reduction strategy? You do have a contract with MONSEE, the Mayor's Office of Neighborhood Safety and Engagement. Took a while to get to that contract. Took a while for those terms to be worked out. But as I understand it, it has been worked out. What is your relationship to that program? And is ROCA the right fit for a group violence reduction strategy?
Yeah, so we work closely with MONSEE, with the mayor's office, and we're the referring partner for those 16 to 24-year-olds that the group violence reduction strategy deems in need of services. So if there's an incident, whether it's a shooting, you know, act of violence, a takedown, and there's a few young people within our age range and they are deemed appropriate, they're group involved, we're doing those door knocks. You know, we're going to weekly meetings, we're discussing, we're case managing, and we are out in the community engaging with those young people and, you know, making sure they're getting the same services that any other young person gets, no different. And, you know, following up, and that's what's so important, is, you know, we can't be in silos. So for GVRS to have worked the way it has and for the results that we've been able to get, it's communication. You know, we can't find so-and-so. Do you have another address? Or, hey, how is so-and-so doing? He's doing great. And, you know, he actually wants this whatever training or service that we don't actually have access to. Can you assist us in getting it? So really just that full-on wraparound approach and collaboration for the young people that, for the most part, are involved in these non-fatal and incidents where there is a homicide.
In terms of cost, you make the case that ROCA is saving the city and the state and the federal government, for that matter, a lot of money. You estimate that a conservative estimate, according to you guys, is that the state of Maryland saved nearly $12 million in incarceration costs over 4 years. In other words, a person in the ROCA program for 4 years is much less expensive than a person in who's incarcerated in a prison over 4 years. What is the how would you assess the general climate for this kind of work here in the state and even around the country? Is this starting to catch on? I mean, Molly Baldwin, who started this, grew up here in Baltimore, has been in Boston for many years. The first programs were in Boston. It's then moved back to her hometown. You've now expanded to Baltimore County. You're not just in Baltimore City. Are you finding that this is on an upward trajectory in terms of acceptance by policymakers and lawmakers?
I would say it's definitely moving in the right direction. You know, this type of work isn't new by any stretch. But I think what programs like ROCA and so many others are able to do now, and even, you know, cities and municipalities that have kind of taken on this approach, is working with data and kind of showing that if we do this many attempts to find a young person, we're more likely to engage with them. Or if we offer them a behavioral health intervention instead of just putting them into juvenile or adult detention facilities, then this is the likely outcome. And, you know, I talked last week, we had an open house. You know, we're so grateful and honored to be able to have purchased our building in Baltimore. And it's so important for the young people to have this safe place permanently for them to come. But I said, you know, ROCA is not the cure-all, and we are and need to be part of a systematic approach to reducing gun violence in Baltimore. And I think across the country, that's the narrative that needs to be told, right? A clear understanding between each provider, whether it's a ROCA, a similar program, hospitals, you know, law enforcement, criminal justice partners, about what is your role in this and how can you help reduce the number of young people who are being incarcerated long-term instead with a diversion or an intervention. And some of them might not be successful, right? You heard it. I think it was 84 of our young people enrolled 24 months or longer. Yeah, we did have to dismiss a few because they reoffended and then they were sentenced to, you know, long-term incarceration. That's unfortunate, but my hope is that the majority, whether it be a ROCA in Baltimore or a different program across the country, is able to accept those services and start working on their healing and do something different instead of, you know, remaining under supervision or being incarcerated or whatever it may be.
Let me ask you real quick as we finish up. I know I need to let you go. Part of the consent decree calls for ROCA to offer training to some 2,000 Baltimore police officers. What kind of training are you going to give, and how would you assess ROCA's relationship with the BPD and the clients that you're working with, their relationship with the police?
So just to answer kind of the relationship piece of that question, the Baltimore City Police Department and ROCA have a great relationship. And in terms of referrals, they're our number one referring partner. And, you know, under the leadership of Commissioner Harrison, we've really operationalized that relationship. So, you know, meetings about referrals, talking about safety and being willing and open to having difficult conversations and how do we best serve these young people together? Because ROCA and the police department and DJS and parole and probation are engaging with and in the lives of these young people on a regular basis. In terms of the training that we're doing both with the police department and with the CMS workers for the Department of Juvenile Services, it's an amended version of our cognitive behavioral theory. So 7 skills, it's all about emotional regulation. And for the police, not only in Baltimore, but in several other cities, we've parsed it down to the 4 most important skills that they've, in feedback groups and discussions, kind of identified as how they can take that 8 to 12 second pause in a very stressful career so that maybe things don't go in a negative way and they have a much better outcome with the individuals that they're engaging with. And hopefully over time that can help heal a relationship between police and these individuals and kind of bring back everyone to the same community working towards the same goal.
Kurt Palermo is the Executive Vice President of ROCA Maryland. Kurt, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. I appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
And coming up, more on strategies to address violence in Baltimore and beyond. Nick Wilson, the Senior Director of Gun Violence Prevention at the Center for American Progress, will join me to talk about what's working around the country when it comes to reducing violence. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, it's Midday on Education. My guest will be Mohammed Chowdhury, the state superintendent of schools. He was appointed to the state's top ed job 2 years ago. His tenure has not been without controversy. We'll talk about the status of his efforts to implement the Blueprint for Maryland's Future and other issues facing Maryland schools. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, we're talking about violence reduction in Baltimore and in communities across the country. My next guest is Nick Wilson, the Senior Director of Gun Violence Prevention at the Center for American Progress. Before joining the center, he worked here in Baltimore as the Associate Director of Policy Planning and Coordination at the Mayor's Office of Neighborhood Safety and Engagement. So he brings a national perspective and local sensitivity and knowledge to this topic. And Nick Wilson joins me in Studio A. Thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
So what's your take on the effectiveness of programs like ROCA and how they integrate into, you know, what Mayor Scott is calling the group violence reduction strategy? As you look at communities around the country, where do programs like ROCA stand in the panoply of those programs?
So community violence intervention and prevention programs are not a new phenomenon. There's a rich history in the African American community of this encouraging alternatives to violence and interrupting it. But it's only been in the last maybe 10, 15 years that there's been really substantial research and investments into this approach. And we're very lucky in Baltimore to have ROCA. ROCA is recognized as a national leader that trains places in New York and California and DC on how to do this work effectively. And what's great about ROCA is that a lot of the, you know, violence intervention work were street interrupters. This has been around for a while and showed a lot of effectiveness in the 90s, both and in the early 2000s in Chicago and Baltimore. But the model hasn't always evolved. And what's interesting about ROCA is they constantly use the latest brain research and the latest best practices to continuously challenge their assumptions. And so we're very lucky to have them as part of the group violence reduction strategy. It's very easy to do prevention work and work with young kids and try to make sure they get on the right path, but it's extremely difficult to work with the highest risk individuals that are at risk of being shot today or being involved in violence. And so they work with the highest risk kids, and it's been saving us a lot of money. And I think it's a big reason why we saw some significant decreases last year in the Western District with the group violence reduction strategy.
Right, yeah, which was sort of piloted in the Western District, and it's now very slowly being rolled out to other places in the city. People lump together ROCA and Safe Streets all the time. Safe Streets, another violence intervention program. Explain to folks how they differ and explain perhaps how they can be melded together because both of them play a role in the group violence reduction strategy here in Baltimore.
There are quite a few differences that are important to understand. But really, one of the big difference is that ROCA really invests not only in the relentless outreach to find these individuals, but they have lots of resources for programming and job training, a lot of partnerships in the community. Unfortunately, Safe Streets, until recently, was really under-resourced. The workers were underpaid. They didn't have adequate training. And they continue to do this dangerous and difficult work every day, and they should be applauded. It's been great to see Mayor Scott invest more in the types of programming and services that will make Safe Streets even more successful. And that's what we've been really seeing, this year, nationally, we're seeing maybe the largest single year decrease in gun violence across the country. Baltimore is no exception. And actually, it's higher in Baltimore, in part because there's been these massive investments in violence intervention and prevention that we're seeing from Democratic mayors across the country.
Why is that, that crime now seems to be, violence seems to be declining in cities like Baltimore, whereas a couple of years ago, it was definitely, there was a huge uptick. The COVID years, people had, initially when COVID came on the scene, thought, well, everybody's going to stay inside, nobody will get shot anymore. That didn't turn out to be the case. What caused the uptick? What's causing the downtick? Do you have any sense of that?
I'd be a very rich man if I could answer that exactly. But there's a lot of good theories out there. In 2020, it was both the gun violence epidemic and the COVID epidemic that kind of collided. And we saw this 35% increase in gun violence across the country, not just in cities, but in rural areas and suburban towns. And it was very concerning. Part of that was the breakdown of institutions and social fabric that are able to prevent some of these violence. There was a lot of anger and a lot of surge in gun sales. And when anger and guns are available, that's when we get deadly consequences. I will say that this year, if the trends continue in the 90 biggest cities where we see a 12% reduction in gun violence, we'll still be higher than in 2019 before the surge happened. But it's very encouraging that, especially in larger cities where we see more Democratic mayors making these investments, not only just in police, but also in prevention and root causes, that's where we're seeing the biggest increases. And so the governor and the mayor deserve credit for those investments.
Also a big increase in youth violence. The victims and the perpetrators are getting younger. We didn't see the kinds of, terribly heartbreaking numbers with, kids in high school shooting each other over various disputes. Any data, any sense of why that's happening? Because it's not just here in Baltimore, it's all over the country.
Exactly right. It's not unique to Baltimore. Philly is usually a good comparison to Baltimore, and they're facing a lot of the same challenges. It's important not to scapegoat this, saying that this is a youth problem. But it isn't concerning when we see these times of spikes. And so, it's very, Governor Moore made an excellent decision by hiring Vinny Schiraldi to be the head of juvenile services. He understands what it takes to be able to, let the low-level offenders, the low-risk offenders out into the community and use programs like ROCA and others to really wrap services around them. And then really for the individuals that are driving the violence, be able to really use the resources to turn their lives around and deter violence. We are seeing trends where, in some places we're seeing these great investments in after-school programs and mental health specifically for young people and these programs. And unfortunately, we're also seeing some regressive kind of 1990s style rhetoric starting to creep up about juveniles. And we don't want to go back to the kind of super predator 1990s rhetoric and things like the curfew, which doesn't have a lot of evidence, but is taking up a lot of time and energy in Baltimore. That could be better spent on more evidence-based ways to reach these individuals.
Brenda Wintrode, our colleague at the Baltimore Banner, they're our news partner here at WYPR, has a terrific story in the Banner today about Mr. Schiraldi and the juvenile services. The reasons that some of these young kids, sometimes as young as 12 or 13, are carrying guns, it's because they fear for their lives. They're in situations where they think the people who are out to get me, they have guns, so I better have one as well. That's a really difficult problem to address when the culture is, look, if I'm the only unarmed person in this fight, I'm going to lose. How does one address that?
This is really a moral failing, not just in Baltimore, but across our country, where some of the most under-resourced communities are both over-policed and underserved, and where they don't feel safe in their own communities like every child should. And so they're more afraid of being caught without a gun when they might be victimized than they are of a police officer catching them with a gun when they shouldn't have one. And then, speaking back to national trends, we're seeing a big trend towards what's called permitless carry, meaning that in a majority of states now, you don't need a permit at all to carry a gun. If you're 18, you can carry one with no training, no background check, no proof that you've ever, you know, handled a firearm. You don't know when you need to retreat and when to de-escalate. And so we're seeing that in these mostly Republican and whiter jurisdictions, we're seeing that there's pretty much no gun laws and no penalties for carrying a gun illegally. But we're seeing in these under-resourced kind of communities, we're seeing a more push to do mandatory minimums and longer prison sentences for people that are just carrying a gun for self-defense. And in my opinion, that is something that we're really grappling with. I've done a lot of research on how permitless carry makes increases double digits gun violence and homicides. We know that it's more dangerous for law enforcement. They get shot more often. But also at the same time, if we're only enforcing gun laws and locking up young black and brown children and letting white people in the suburbs be able to carry a gun with no consequences, it's starting to undermine the legitimacy of our gun laws. And at our research in American Progress, we think a lot about the unintended consequences and the disproportionate impact of our gun laws and the so-called war on guns that's currently happening. And so it's a really interesting time, and I challenge our city and state and federal leaders to really think about the rhetoric they use and the policies they propose, that while it might sound politically expedient for now, it's really going to set us up for some serious long-term impacts.
And I want to talk about what Congress can do, what the state legislature can do, what the city can do in terms of gun policy when we come back from a quick break. Nick Wilson is the Senior Director of Gun Violence Prevention at the Center for American Progress. We will take a quick break, and we'll have more, and we'll take calls and comments if you have to, if you have ideas that you'd like to contribute to our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about strategies to reduce gun violence in Baltimore and beyond. The CDC reports that in 2021, more Americans died of gun-related injuries from murder or by suicide than in any other year on record. But because of population growth in the United States, the rate of gun deaths as a factor of the total U.S. population is still lower than in earlier decades. My guest is Nick Wilson. He's the former Associate Director of Policy Planning and Coordination at the Baltimore City Mayor's Office of Neighborhood Safety and Engagement, and he now serves as the Senior Director of Gun Violence Prevention at the Center for American Progress. Nick Wilson joins me here in Studio A. You are welcome to join us as well, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. So, Nick, is there a jurisdiction, a state, a city that serves as a paradigm for what other jurisdictions should be doing in terms of gun regulation policy? You wrote a piece for the Center for American Progress about the state of Delaware, which has a whole series of very strong gun regulations on the books. As everybody else experienced an uptick around the country, even Delaware did as well. But what about Delaware do you think can perhaps serve as a model for others?
Delaware has increased its laws significantly in recent years, and it's been exciting to see them push for a permit to purchase, which is one of the most effective gun laws there is. We have one here in Maryland that's very significant. What's interesting, though, is states have varying gun laws, and you know, we're seeing right now red states are weakening their gun laws and blue states are strengthening their gun laws, and we're seeing more and more gun violence in these red states with the weak gun laws. But what's unfortunate is these states with weak gun laws, the guns still can flow from those states to states with strong gun laws. And so I think we're seeing that in Delaware, and no matter how strong Maryland gets its gun laws, as long as we have, you know, West Virginia nearby and other places, people will be able to go to Walmart parking lot and buy an assault weapon with no questions asked and bring it across state lines. So we look at places like Massachusetts and Hawaii, which compete every year to have the lowest gun violence rate. And not only do they have really strong gun laws and these discretionary permit to purchase systems where law enforcement has some discretion, if they're like, okay, well, you aren't legally prohibited from having a gun because maybe you pled down on this case, or maybe you had, you know, 3 DUIs in 6 years instead of 5 years to be disqualified. But the police chief or law enforcement can be like, well, we've been to your house a lot for domestic violence calls or, you know, bar fights. Maybe you shouldn't have one. And what is also another advantage is Hawaii is surrounded by water. And so it's a lot harder for guns to flow from into there from states with weak gun laws. And then Massachusetts is surrounded in New England by some of the strongest gun laws. And so they'll have to go up to Maine where there's weaker gun laws, or have to go a lot further south than 95. And so that's why we really need Congress to act, because otherwise we're going to continue having these disparities.
It's called in some quarters the Iron Pipeline of guns coming from Tennessee and from other places in the south, as well as, you know, places to the north of Maryland. What is the answer? How do we limit the number of guns that are out there? I mean, the accessibility of guns is something that Police Commissioner Harrison and I talk about every time he's on the show. He just says there's just so many guns out there. The mayor talks about this. I mean, most political leaders, at least those on the left-hand side of the aisle, talk about accessibility of firearms as being one of the root causes of the extreme violence that we're seeing.
Yeah, and that's a big part of the crime surge that we saw in the 2020 and beyond, was that for a while, gun sales were people that were buying their 7th, 8th, 9th gun, and they were adding to their collection, but we weren't seeing as many new gun owners. But people started getting afraid, and places like the NRA and the corporate gun lobby, you know, they've hired Madison Avenue type branding and marketing firms to figure out, how do we sell guns to new people? They literally came up with this thing called Weaponless Wendy, and women weren't buying enough guns. And so they're like, we have to make women afraid and thinking that the only way to keep themselves safe was to carry a gun. And so we've seen a lot more accessibility, and people that are buying a gun that never had one, they're not storing it safely. They're not being responsible. It's excellent that after many years, Jalen's Law, Safe Storage Bill, finally passed in the legislature this year, thanks to Marylanders to Prevent Gun Violence and Governor Moore and leaders in the legislature. But it's a tricky thing. That's why a lot of this needs to happen at the federal level. The Bipartisan Safer Community Act, which passed a year ago, the first significant gun bill in 30 years, it finally made interstate gun trafficking a federal offense. And so now the ATF is able to start enforcing and citing people for those illegal activities. But we need to give more money to the ATF so that they can hire more inspectors. They're supposed to inspect these dealers, you know, annually or semi-annually. And unfortunately, they're just so understaffed, and they have so much restrictions on them by Congress that they aren't able to do their job. And we also need more data collection and more states working together in regions to share data and to find out which routes are being used and who are trafficking these gun laws. And instead of arresting, you know, a 13-year-old in Baltimore for having an illegal gun, spend more of the resources on the people that are really trafficking these guns and causing devastation in our communities.
If we don't arrest the 13-year-old who because he has a gun, then what do we do instead?
I mean, carrying a gun, especially at that young age, is a very high risk risk factor. And so we do need programs like ROCA, and especially for younger people, other programs that unfortunately haven't been invested in under Governor Hogan. Under 8 years, the investments at the state and local level have really diminished. So we need to beef up these organizations that can spend a lot of time with those children and in the community, as opposed to setting them far away from their families. And by decreasing that access to their friends and family, it shows that it's actually counterproductive to public safety.
You mentioned the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. This was pushed through by Senator Murphy from Connecticut. Of course, Connecticut, home to Newtown, that horrible mass shooting of the children, you know, what, 10 years ago. That includes $250 million for violence interruption programs like Safe Streets and ROCA. What else is there any optimism at all for those who would like to have stricter federal gun regulation. Is there any more appetite in Congress to move to the next step, or do you think the president is going to, you know, back off of gun regulation and look to other policy areas?
I definitely know that President Biden will not be backing off on this issue. I meet with his staff regularly, and they're always looking for new ideas, new executive orders, new actions that they can take. But as we saw with the debt ceiling, even the most basic governance is very difficult in this area. And so we're not expecting a ton of new gun laws in the coming times. But if you had asked me a year and a half ago if I thought that there would be federal gun legislation, I would have said no. And Senator Murphy and his colleagues were really able to put together, you know, a package of like eight different excellent policies into one package and pass it. And so you never know. But right now, we're really focusing on implementing that law. There are so many components to it: money for extremist protection orders, so-called red flag laws, money for after-school programs for mental health. CDC and DOJ significant money for community violence intervention, which they announced those in Baltimore with ROCA last year. So there's a lot of exciting things happening at Congress, but, you know, it's really frustrating we can't get an assault weapons ban passed. That's something that we had for 10 years in this country, and it was very effective, despite it not being a perfectly written bill. And even something like that hasn't been able to move.
Yeah, and when it comes to assault weapons ban or background checks, these are things that, you know, have a lot of public support, certainly. In our last minute or so, how is it that the tenor, you know, the difference between public support and, you know, political will is so disparate, remains so disparate? I mean, what's your explanation for this? Is it the NRA is still this, you know, great behemoth effective lobbying thing, or is it something else? Is this part of the culture wars that the, you know, Republican Party is adopting? What explains it in your mind?
It's a great question. The NRA is not as strong as it once was. It's had a lot of challenges. But I do think, unfortunately, some of their narrative, we didn't push back enough in a real time. And some of these really dangerous myths have become common sense in a lot of these communities, such as guns make you safer. Only a good guy with a gun can stop a bad guy with a gun. And the Second Amendment is some absolute right.
Or that the gun laws only affect people, you know, law-abiding citizens.
Exactly. Exactly right. But this really paints to a bigger structural problem with our politics. It's not just the gun issue where popular policies, you know, look at abortion, you look at environment and climate change. You know, there's really serious problems with how our system is set up to challenge, to do these big programs. But most gun owners support background checks and red flag laws. Most Republicans do. So I'm hopeful that in the long run, we will win. But we have a lot of challenges to face right now.
Nick Wilson is the Senior Director of Gun Violence Prevention at the Center for American Progress. Thanks, Nick. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for us today. And coming up tomorrow, we'll talk education with my guest, the Maryland State School Superintendent, Mohammed Chowdhury. So I hope you can join us then tomorrow on Midday with Superintendent Chowdhury. Coming up now, it's Here and Now. That's after news at the top of the hour. And I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.